Blog Talk Radio.
Sing through my voice, play through my hands, let the way be
of the Sacred Feminine. That lovely song you were just listening to, that little snippet, was Let the Way Be Open by Abigail Spinner McBride. Thank you, Abigail. We appreciate that. And as always, I thank you for tuning in tonight live, or if you can't, you can always catch us from the archives. Many of you have been looking forward, as I have, to our very special guest tonight, Frank Schaefer, author of several books, Patience with God, Keeping Faith, and Crazy for God. You may have read Frank or heard him when he's appeared on NPR, CNN, or MSNBC, Fox News. He also blogs for the Huffington Post. Well, Frank's married. He and his wife, Jeannie, live in Massachusetts with their three kids. And I first heard Frank on the Rachel Maddow Show, I believe. My ears perked up because he was talking about his former life on the religious right. He referred to himself, I believe, as a former Christian fundamentalist, lamenting the direction of the religious right and how it had gone astray. Well, needless to say, his voice felt like one of sanity, courageously speaking truth like we seldom hear. So I certainly wanted to hear this insider's opinion about this religious right movement going wrong. Frank has said, we must save Christianity from Christians, which myself, as a former and recovering Catholic, has thought many times, and as I believe many of my listeners have thought as well. But Frank had the courage to state it publicly, like so many of our other heroes who have spoken out, like Matthew Fox, Roy Bourgeois, former President Jimmy Carter, Pastor Stacey Bourne of her church in San Francisco, and the women who are daring to defy the Vatican and become ordained as priests. So let's get right to it. Let me invite Frank to join us. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Karen.
Well, did I get that intro right, or does anything?
Yes. No, you got everything. You got everything right on there.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Well, Frank, why don't you start out? For our listeners who maybe are just discovering you, tell us about your life on the religious right and how or why you left the movement.
Okay. Well, it goes back a ways. I grew up in Switzerland. My parents were American evangelical missionaries who went over to Switzerland in the 40s, and I was born in the 50s. And that's where I grew up, in a little fundamentalist mission called Le Brie Fellowship. And no one had heard of my parents, and they were just over there doing their thing. And I was a kid running around in this mission with loving parents, a lot of strict rules, people coming to talk to my dad and study about God and culture and all the rest of it. And then in the 1960s, my parents began to write books, and Dad became better known, and all of a sudden we had a whole different sort of guest arriving, evangelical leaders like Billy Graham, Barbara Bush, the Bush family. Timothy Leary showed up for a while, the old father of the hippie culture that came out of Harvard in the 60s with his pushing acid, dropout, turn on, and all the rest of it. And then Le Brie became a kind of a countercultural hub. But that was in the period of time when a lot of backpackers were in Europe on their way to India, to ashrams. The Beatles were out with the Maharishi. So it was that atmosphere. But my dad was still very much a fundamentalist Christian in his theology, though. You know, he grew his hair long and became a kind of a precursor to the Jesus movement, which was this amalgam of the kind of hippie ethos combined with the gospel. Then in 1973, after Roe v. Wade, Dad took a very strong stand against Roe v. Wade, and all of a sudden he became part of the beginning of the religious right. He was the person who talked Jerry Falwell into taking a stand on that issue. And like so many nepotistic sidekicks to their fathers in the Christian business or the God business, you know, Pat Robertson's son followed him. Reverend Schuller at the Christian Cathedral, his son followed him. Oral Roberts, these people. I became for a while, about a 10-year period, my dad's sidekick. And during that time, he became very famous and in the evangelical circles and was hobnobbing with Presidents Ford, Reagan, Bush, Senior, and so forth. And so what I lived through, what I saw as a young man from the inside, because I was part of it, was really the rise of two things, not just the religious right, but the takeover of the Republican Party by some people who issued litmus tests on issues like abortion, gay rights, and other things. And depending how you answered those questions, they would either be for you and vote for you or against you. And so what I saw was a transition where, first of all, Christianity became very politicized when it came to right-wing Christianity anyway. And then the Republican Party became very Christianized, if you define Christianity as right-wing fundamentalism. And I saw that happen. And then in about 1985, my dad died in 84, I really got out of the movement in disgust with the direction it was going in, a journey I describe in a memoir I wrote called Crazy for God. And the subtitle sort of tells the story, how I grew up as one of the elect, helped found the religious right, and lived to take all or almost all of it back. And that book, along with the companion volume, Patience with God, which is subtitled Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, tells a story, first of all, my story of my journey and passage through the religious right, why and how I got out, but also traces the arc of the rise to power of fundamentalist Christianity in this country. And now if you fast forward to the present, you look at the Tea Party movement, you look, for instance, at the accusation that if we had health care reform, we'd have death panels and all these other things. You see the language that we brought into being during the fight over abortion now being turned against health care reform, being turned against our first African-American president, where he's called the Antichrist, for instance, by a bunch of evangelicals and other people who are on the extreme right. And you see that this story, far from having gone away, in fact, has exploded into the headlines again with people like Sharon Angle and all these others who are running to the far right on the Tea Party ticket. I won't even call it the Republican Party ticket at this point. Really what they've done and what people like Glenn Beck and Fox News have done is simply amplify and take further the anti-government, fundamentally anti-American in the sense of being anti-pluralistic, anti-democratic movement that we were part of. And so I have seen the rise of this. I've been part of it. I've gotten out, and now I'm very much a critic from the other side of where it went, and I think it's an extremely dangerous direction for this country to go in. And, you know, just to bring it right up to the present, I hope these November elections show that the American people are more sensible than voting for some of these extreme candidates. And that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of the journey for you.
Well, thank you. That was incredibly thorough, and I certainly agree. Quite frankly, I'm afraid to what I'm going to wake up to on November 3rd.
Right.
You know, one of the things I think that perplexes the people I know the most, and the people, you know, some of my listeners who've emailed in questions, what they can't understand is why so many on the right are so loud about loving Jesus, but they seem to, like, totally ignore what he really stood for and did and preached. I mean, how do they reconcile that?
Well, there's two things to be said here. First of all, anybody can reconcile anything. If you politicize your religion, then really the cart and the horse have reversed order. The cart's pulling the horse here, because religion is nothing to do with this anymore. This is bare-knuckle politics. And a very good example of that is the way, for instance, some of these major corporate interests when it came to the insurance business, or the Koch brothers with their oil business, have moved in and begun to fund some of these far-right parties that wrap themselves both in the flag and the Bible, but actually it's all about corporate interests. And, you know, there are the guys on the street, if you want to put it this way, sometimes who are not too bright, usually white, lower middle class Americans, who, the kind of folks you saw screaming at the healthcare town hall meetings during the last round of debates on healthcare, But the way this has really come down is that it's less to do with religion than it is to do with corporate politics, right-wing politics, and religion is being used. That's one answer. The other answer is a little more difficult and hard for people to swallow, particularly religious people. And I have to add here, I consider myself a Christian. I go to the Greek Orthodox Church. There's a reason for that in the sense that I like liturgical worship and I like the ancient forms of worship that come with the church. But that said, the fact of the matter is that if you actually read the Bible, there's a great deal of misogyny, violence, a great deal of nonsense in the Bible itself, which, you know, you can parse any way you want. And so it's like the same discussions you hear on the Quran. You know, there's verses about peace and love and tolerance. There's also verses about killing people who don't agree with you and justifying that. And I'm afraid the Bible's exactly the same. And so even the testimony of Jesus Christ can be divided into several parts. If you look at the book of Revelation that predicts his return to slaughter everybody on earth who doesn't agree with the party line, you know, this is not the Jesus most people hope is the actual founder of the Christian religion. But nevertheless, there it is in the Bible. So to be perfectly frank about it, you have to decide one thing at the outset if you're a religious person, and that is, are you going to swallow whole cloth everything that comes with whatever tradition you plug into, or are you going to think, and are you going to make your choices, and are you going to decide how you're going to follow something? That would be the kind of religion I'm more interested in. And if that's the kind of religion you're interested in, then what we need to do is try to find that common thread of humanity that runs through the teachings of, say, the Bible, if we're Christians, or Jews, or the Quran, if we're interested in Islam, or other teachings, and use the same faculties of reason that we apply to everything else in life, and not just swallow everything hook, line, and sinker. And so, unfortunately, the far religious right is able to find whatever they want in the Bible to justify what they're doing, because there's plenty of harsh verses, there's plenty of teachings in the Bible that can be applied either in or out of context, that's another discussion, to bolster this sort of harsh, ugly view of the human race. Just to take one example, the harsh and ugly view of women. You know, you just have to take one obscure thread that runs through the Bible, for instance, and that is that the teachings in the Old and New Testament, particularly the Old Testament, on the whole issue of menstruation, or, you know, bodily fluids, even male bodily fluids, where you have the death penalty inflicted for people who touch quote-unquote unclean objects like menstrual blood and all these kinds of things. Well, you know, that's all in that book too. So love your neighbor, yep, that's in there, but so is pro-slavery stuff, so is all kinds of misogyny, so is the sanctioning of rape in certain cases, all kinds of things that are just shocking and that, you know, the evangelical and the Christian community want to pretend they don't have to deal with. Well, the problem is they're actually there. And so when you get an unhinged right wing, there's plenty in the scripture that they can draw on to justify anything they want to do, just like slave traders used to draw on certain Bible verses to sanction slavery.
So it's not a matter of morality or common sense. It's really a cherry picking. With the it really boils down to cherry picking ideas to justify a political agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I write about in Patience with God is the fact that you have a similar cherry picking both on the left and the right. You know, you have for instance, from the Patience with God, the subtitle is Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism. If you look at, for instance, some of the leading new atheists today, the so-called new atheists, for instance, Christopher Hitchens or Dawkins or Harris or these other people, they do their own form of cherry picking. In other words, they go through this history of secularism and say, well, the problem all comes from religion. Well, that's nice and convenient until you remember that Pol Pot, Stalin, Mao Zedong, and the rest of them were all not only atheists, but they were people who came from a leftist position. Look, the real fundamental problem we all have is not the label by which we label ourselves, Christian or atheist or agnostic. It's that human beings have a very dark side to our nature. We're a newly evolved species. A couple of eye blinks ago, in terms of cosmic time, we were single-celled creatures floundering around in the mud somewhere, and now, you know, we have evolved to a point where we can do ourselves and everything else great harm, but unfortunately our ethics have not evolved and kept pace with our ability to harm ourselves and others. And so the truth of the matter is, it isn't that one group of people has the answer, capital T, capital A, the answer. It's that we are all in a position where we have got to be very careful with what we do, say, and think, and not look to one group, one book, one church, as if somehow it has all the answers. That's
right.
that's not where we're going to find solutions to our problems.
Well, and I hear all of that, and it makes sense. It makes perfect sense. But then there's the other part of me that goes, but, you know, we're talking about, you know, human beings. We're talking about this ugly anti-immigrant, anti-homophobia,
right,
anti-woman, anti-science, you know, anti-anything that's not exactly like them. And it just, it's really hard to understand that anybody could really justify that.
Yeah, but of course, you know, and sadly, if you look at the history of the United States, going, you know, I'm sitting here in Massachusetts tonight talking to you, and you're out there in California, but, you know, just a stone's throw down the road from me, the Puritan settlers in the 17th century burned a whole village of Pequot Indians to death, including women and children, that they shut in a stockade and then torched. And they did it in the name of the God of the Bible, who had brought them to claim this new promised land, that they were the new chosen people, and they looked at these Pequot Indians the way the Old Testament describes the Canaanites and the Midianites and the other people that the Jews killed, feeling led by God to do the same. You know, this goes back to the beginning of our history. We've always had what I think of as the American lynch mob out there, and in one generation it strings up black people, and another generation it calls Franklin Roosevelt a communist and an agent of socialism, and another generation it's saying that Barack Obama is the Antichrist. It's trying to take away women's rights at another point. It's bashing gay people in some other point. And so there's this reactionary thread runs all the way through our politics. But parallel to it, we have another thread, and that is represented best right now by Barack Obama, the Franklin Roosevelts of this world, the Barack Obamas, the reasonable people who try to bring about change and governance from an enlightened and humanistic point of view. And that also is there. So it's not a question of despair or giving up or saying everything's terrible. It's just one of ceaseless vigilance and saying that in each generation this American lynch mob comes forward. Now, it so happens that my family, as I talk about in Crazy for God, had a lot to do with one particular incarnation of the American lynch mob. We didn't invent it, but the pro-life movement soon was devolved into something that had nothing to do with being pro-life and everything to do with keeping right-wing American politicians in power. You know, after all, the Republican Party basically controlled American politics for the better part of 40 years, and they never did anything to actually, I wouldn't even say stop, but help women with difficult pregnancies to not have abortions. You know, where was the national health care policy? Where was the aid to dependent families? Where was the national daycare policy? Where were any of these things that would have actually made a positive contribution? Instead of that, all you had was lip service on the issue, and it became a litmus test by which you could beat your opponent over the head and win votes, but there was no seriousness in actually doing anything practical to help people. And so, you know, when you look at the actual track record of the right and the religious right in this country, it's never been about the issues they're talking about. Those issues are always just a tool for another end, and that end starts with just keeping power. And in terms of the Republican Party, keeping power and serving the folks that the Republican Party is really about these days, and that is corporate interests. And you do anything you can to do that. So, for instance, an example right now is the way that Dick Armey, who used to be a congressman on the far right of the Republican Party, you know, now runs a consulting group called FreedomWorks. Many multi-millions of dollars pour through that, as they do through Karl Rove's lobby group, and they go back out to things like the Tea Party and the rest of it that's been totally co-opted by these corporate interests that are just playing games with them, in the same way that those same corporate interests co-opted the pro-life movement and the anti-abortion folks, used them to help their people stay in power, never did anything about the issue itself. Similarly, that's what's going on right now. And so, you know, you keep seeing these cycles going through it. It's just that I've been around long enough in terms of observing this issue from the inside so that I can actually understand what's going on. And that's not a cynical view. I just think it's a realistic view.
Right. Well, Frank, I know this. It's hard to separate the Christianity from the politics. I mean, I totally get that. In fact, you know, when I'm having conversations with people, you know, I'm either saying Christian or religious right. I mean, it's like the words are Republican. It's almost like the words are interchangeable. But I wonder, I mean, do you think maybe we've given Christians too wide a berth? You know, we've let them get away with way too much under the guise of religion that was really a veil for a political agenda, and nobody wants to challenge them on it. You know, it's like if you're a Christian, oh, well, you're a sacred cow, you know,
right.
then you know, well, nobody can question you because, you know, you're doing it for your God.
Yeah,
you know?
I totally agree. I think two things have been given a pass in the American debate, and that's, you know, religious tolerance, religious freedom, the whole tax-deductible aspect of religion. Listen, you know, the fact of the matter is that in the States, because we have this idea that religious freedom is sacrosanct, which it is in some ways, but not without limits, just like everything else has to have limits, we've allowed people to grandstand and get away with things which are just absurd and build empires. You know, just take Pat Robertson, for instance. I was on the 700 Club when Pat was starting out many times. Or James Dobson with his focus on the family. He gave away 150,000 copies of a right-wing book I wrote once called A Time for Anger back in the mid-80s. And, you know, I know these men well. They have built literal multi-billion dollar empires. Robertson and Dobson between them employ directly and indirectly about 15,000 people on the payroll in the college and in all these various ministries that they run. They have huge business interests worldwide. They've run these corporations as quote ministries that then become companies that control nonprofits that then control for-profit companies. It's a nepotistic you know, system, almost like North Korea. I know because I did the same thing with my dad. So everybody's sons and brothers and daughters-in-law and everyone else work up being called, quote-unquote, into the ministry. And on it goes. And no one says anything about it. And the other thing is, too, that when you look at the imposition of religious ideas into politics, you know, what you have in America today is genuinely a soft theocracy. You know, it's not Iran, it's not Saudi Arabia, I'm not making a parallel with that, this is not the American Taliban, but it's in that direction. And so when you look, for instance, just to take one detail, at a thing called the Reconstructionist movement or the Theonomists that came out of the 60s and 70s that talked about applying biblical law literally to the United States, nobody took them terribly seriously. And yet, when you look at the people like Robertson, Jerry Falwell, my dad, Francis Schaeffer, me for a short time, really, if you took the logic of what we were doing to where we would have liked to see it go, we would have had a theocracy in this country. You'd have biblically based laws. So all these people talk about, well, we got to recapture America for Jesus. We have to base our laws on the Bible. You know, people ought to stop for a minute and think, well, what does that mean? That means that you basically say the Bible will become our founding document, not our Constitution, not our Bill of Rights, not the rule of law. And how would the Bible be applied? Well, it would be interpreted by your religious leaders, just like Sharia law is. And that's not the American way. It's not democratic. It's not enlightened. It's not humanistic. And the fact is, we have this group of people. They're not going to take over the country. I'm not saying the sky is falling. But they're going to continue to cause real problems. First problem is going to be that they derail things like the gay rights movement and really hurt people. They try to take away women's rights. They skew the elections in favor of corporate America. They get their people on the Supreme Court, and they pass, they hand down a ruling just within a year ago now where you've got corporate interests allowed to finance political campaigns without limit, and they can
right.
do so anonymously. Well,
right.
when you start adding all that stuff up, it has
it's
a tremendous
powerful.
Impact on our country. It's very
right.
powerful.
Well, forgive me if this is a naive question, but I have to ask it anyway. I think I really, really noted. I started to really connect some dots that I hadn't seen connected before when there was this huge backlash to the movie Avatar, because the Christians seemed to get so upset. And you know, and I started thinking to myself, well, when did Christianity start? You know, become about money and patriotism and corporatism?
Right.
You know, and maybe it's because I'm come from a Catholic background, so I wasn't looking at Jerry Falwell and these evangelical ministers making a bunch of money on television.
Right.
I was used to nuns and priests who basically took a vow of poverty. You know, so that was sort of my, the leaders in my church, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I guess it's a two-prong question. Has it always been about money, patriotism, and corporatism, and I just didn't know it? And number two, I think the question would be, and I don't know if you can answer this, okay, I realize the evangelicals have their little empires on television and it's all about the money, but what about the other religious figures who aren't just in it for the bucks? You know,
why are they
not speaking out for the people?
Yeah, to be brutal about it, the flakes who are in it for the money are not the trouble, because they're very transparent. The problem with somebody like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and Dr. Dobson, sure, they built corporate empires. The problem is they actually believe what they are saying, or did it one time sincerely, and they're sincerely wrong, but they sincerely believe that the only way that America could thrive was to adopt a biblical Christian base. And what they meant by that was a right-wing fundamentalist type of biblical Christianity. There's all kinds of other kind of Christianity, but they weren't looking at that. There are Christians who are very progressive. There are Christians who are very tolerant. There are Christians who are very open. So I'm not saying they represented all Christianity, but their right-wing vision of Christian America was one that would be very much in the direction of the one that in the 17th century put Anne Hutchinson on trial for heresy because as a woman she dared to teach and interpret scripture in the church, and they threw her out of the Bay State Colony. And basically that tradition continues. That's the problem. These folks have been serious. They believe what they're saying. Another example is Franklin Graham today, Billy Graham's son. Billy was quite a tolerant guy. I remember back in the 80s we tried to involve him in our anti-abortion crusade, and he refused. Said it's too political, it's not my issue. But his son Franklin is a leading homophobe. He bashes gays, he's anti-Islamic, he goes around the country talking about the coming persecution of Christians because he says they're all going to be marched off because of being accused of hate crimes, because he sees a threat in legislation to legalize gay marriage, this kind of thing. And you look at this and you realize the problem here is not that he's making money, which he is. You know, these guys are all flying around in their own planes. In fact, Franklin Graham loaned Sarah Palin his ministry plane so she could use it during her book tour for her last book. There's a very close relationship there. But the problem is they're very serious people. They believe what they're talking about, and they believe it in the same way that people who start all sorts of political movements believe what they say. So, you know, sincerity is a very overrated virtue. Just because someone's sincere doesn't make them right. And the religious right, as I talk about in Crazy for God, and then my new book, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, the problem that I talk about in these books is not that these folks are flakes. That would be easily dismissed. The problem is they're very serious people who believe what they're saying to be true. Now, they also build empires. They also believe in having a good life. They make plenty of money going the way through. They open the door for people who are real charlatans and flakes. But the key players here are not. They're very serious, dedicated people. They just also happen to be very seriously wrong.
Well, what about the anti-intellectualism aspect of it? It's almost as if, you know, I think of Sarah Palin, for instance. I feel like she sort of wears her lack of knowledge and awareness like a badge of honor. In the Texas, Board of Education,
right.
You know, rewriting history books.
Right.
I mean, you know, this just defies common sense. And here I'm using that word again, common sense.
Yeah.
But it's hard to fathom it, I guess.
Well, I think what we got to look at here is, you know, one thing I always think of when I'm talking with somebody is trying to imagine what the best of all worlds would be for them. What is the favorite period of history for the folks you just talked about? Sarah Palin coming from her Assemblies of God church, the Texas Board of Education folks doing the textbooks. You talk to these folks, what's their favorite part of history? Who are their heroes? Well, I'm sorry to say it's the Bronze Age. If you look, it's a collection of short stories in the Old Testament that they call the Bible, that they take both literally and look to guide their lives. And it's Bronze Age tribal warfare and history. and a very crude God that chooses one group of people to commit genocide against everybody else they meet in the Middle East and takes the land in his name, and then have laws to declare women unclean when they menstruate and men unclean when they discharge semen, and you can't mix wool and cotton, and if you blaspheme, you're going to be killed, and if you dishonor your parents, you're going to be killed, and if you're gay, you're going to be killed. This is their favorite era of history. You've got to understand that. We look at the Bible as a religious book, but just for a minute, take it on the face value that they pitch.
Frank, for some reason I can't hear you again.
I can hear you.
Oh, shoot.
I can hear you.
Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Frank?
Yep, I hear you. I hear you.
Frank, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there.
Okay, now you're back. You're back.
Yeah, I heard you the whole time, by the way.
I don't know. I've never
there?
Had that happen before. I don't know what the problem is. I'm sorry. I guess just, you know, keep going.
Yeah, so I was just saying, look, you have to understand that the favorite period of history for people who take the Bible literally is the Bronze Age. And the Bronze Age is a very, very crude, cruel time. And these folks take their laws from Bronze Age myths. And it's the myths upon which the Old Testament is built. And then, you know, the other part of the Bible comes out of the Greco-Roman era. Well, these are not enlightened times. This, you know, the Greco-Roman era is when two-thirds of the population were slaves, when slavery was in the norm. Jesus uses slavery in a parable where he talks about it just like a normal thing and says, you know, this is what slaves expect of people. This is what masters expect. We give these things a religious spin, and so we let them off the hook. And that's fine, because I think we should let them off the hook. A lot of it is euphemistic and allegorical, okay. But for the people who take this seriously, like a Sarah Palin, for instance, you have to understand that she's looking at the world through a completely different set of glasses than you are. Her heroes are in the Bronze Age. They're people like King David, who slaughtered all God's enemies. This is where she starts. And then when you update that, her biggest threat comes from East Coast universities, what she calls the major media, the liberals, anybody who, you know, has more than a high school education, people who are enlightened or who are well-read are a threat. Why? Because they don't see the world where their heroes are Bronze Age heroes. They don't see the world where you believe in a six-day literal creation. They don't see a world where you take laws against homosexuality totally seriously and apply them and are rooting for the death penalty in Uganda that wanted to bring the death penalty in based on this evangelical idea of gays choosing this sinful lifestyle and so forth. And so there's a huge divide here, but it doesn't just go to American politics. You always have to look, who is somebody's heroes? And if your hero are Bronze Age tyrants, repackaged in the Bible as godly people, then you got a problem, and you're going to look at the world that way.
Well, let's talk about women for a minute, and you know, whether we're talking about Sarah Palin or Sharon Engel or Christine
right.
O'Donnell, I guess it's a little. And again, maybe you know, like you said, Bronze Age versus contemporary women. But as a woman, I guess I would think, why wouldn't they, you know, kind of try to buck the programming? You know, why would they want to continue being in a group that sees them as second-class citizens, so to speak? You know, why wouldn't they want to get away from that?
Well, I can only speak to my own family. You know, my mother, my sisters, and the situation I saw them in, the women in Christian circles. First of all, women find a way always to use whatever's around them, just like any human being does. To do the best they can with. So, for instance, my mom, who's forbidden from teaching in our church because she was a woman and women couldn't preach, you know, mastered the art of Bible studies and talks outside of church, and all of a sudden she became a spiritual leader in her own right. All sorts of people were running around reading Edith Schaefer books from a denomination where she couldn't officially teach. And then you have a kind of a double standard. So the first thing is, it's never black and white. You always have women finding a way to express themselves, even in a religious tradition that is very strict. But the second thing is, I think a lot of women are browbeaten and conditioned from childhood. I mean, look at this quiverful movement that says women have to have all the babies they can, no contraception is allowed, we need to have all these warriors for Jesus out there, homeschool them, unleash them on the society to reclaim it for Jesus, that's your duty. And those women are brought up in families. We're getting into the second and third generation of it now that sound more like Saudi Arabia, where some of these folks aren't allowed to drive. They're never allowed to go to school. They're all homeschooled. They don't go to any secular schools. They don't go to high school. They are homeschooled. Then they stay home until their parents introduce them to a suitable mate. Doesn't sound like America, but it's actually happening. And so then look at somebody like Sarah Palin and the theology of the Assemblies of God Church, this absolute backward Bronze Age commitment to theology, so that they're conditioned. They're doing the best they can by the light they've been given. The light they've been given is mighty dim. And then, of course, and I know this sounds awful, but the truth of the matter is if you look at any of the great tyrannies of history, for instance, the Nazis and the way they treated the Jews, there are always a few Jews, there's always a few Frenchmen, there's always a few people who collaborate, there's always some people who go with the program thinking somehow that they can become leaders in it. You know, sadly, there are people who give up their own best interests, who vote against their own best interests because of emotional reasons. You have all kinds of people who are not so well off who vote Republican and vote against their own interests because they've been indoctrinated with the politics. So I think you have all those reasons. But fundamentally, when it comes to the evangelical women who are really anti-feminist, you have to understand who their heroes are. Their heroes are Bronze Age people who are backwards.
Okay.
That's where they come from.
Well, that is what I'm going to keep in the back of my mind every time I see Sarah Palin on television.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's sort of switch gears a little bit. You have been just wonderful sort of setting this whole stage, but I want to sort of ask a few other things. Well, but first, if you had to predict what was going to happen after the election, do you think these people are really going to, carry the day?
No. I think that America is a better country than that. I think that they're not going to get a majority in either House of Congress, and then I think that Barack Obama is going to be elected to a second term, and by the time his presidency is done, his critics both on the right and the left are going to really have to eat some humble pie, because I think he's a great president, and I think he has a very long-term vision for this country, and that the problem is not him. It's trying to govern people who think in sound bites, who have no patience, and who very quickly forget what the alternatives are. And so I think the Democrats are going to do better, but of course they're only going to do so if people get out and vote
and
organize themselves.
And how do we counter Fox News, Citizens United? I mean, how do we fight up against this huge wave? I mean, other than, you know, trying to get unmotivated voters out to vote. I mean, does the left have to get more money or more influence or more fight?
Yeah, I think people have to donate to the Democratic Party, and I also think that whether you disagree with certain things that Barack Obama's done or don't think he's moved quickly enough or whatever your personal peeves are, you have to look at what the stakes are and get out there and work to help this administration succeed. It's not that we don't have an alternative. We do, and the alternative right now is the Obama administration. Look, I mean, look at the track record. We have our first African-American president. He's appointed our first Hispanic judge to the Supreme Court, who also happens to be a woman. He's the first person who has stood strong on wanting to stop the don't ask, don't tell policy in the military. It may be moving slower than folks want, but he's on the right side on that. He's restored our respect around the world to levels that this country hasn't seen since John F. Kennedy was assassinated. You know, there's a lot going right at this point. And I just think that the real answer is pretty mundane, and that is when the economy comes back a little bit, which it's going to, we'll see a change in a lot of people's attitudes. But for the time being, people who know what's what have got to really fight for this administration, whether it's talking to people and getting them to vote in the election, or whether it's just speaking up when we hear things. And when it comes to Fox News, you know, yeah, the rabid, crazy, ugly right is always there. In the 1930s, it was Reverend Coughlin, who was this Roman Catholic hellraiser, priest who was pro-fascist and against Roosevelt. Back in my day, when I was out there on the hustings with the evangelical right, it was Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority. Now it's the Tea Party and Engel and all these other folks in the anti-immigrant movement. You know, there's always a different guise and a cloak here, but it's always the same vibe. And right now, Fox is carrying the water. I think that the threat of Fox is really not Fox. It's Rupert Murdoch and his multi-billion-dollar international media corporation that's trying to push the whole world toward the far right. That's the problem. And, you know, Glenn Beck by himself would just be out there howling at the moon somewhere. No one would be listening to him. But you give him a microphone and put a couple of $1 billion behind the corporation to give him a network exposure, and you've got a different situation. So when you look at some characters like, for instance, Glenn Beck, he's just sort of like a Father Coughlin for today. The problem is that when you look at somebody like Rupert Murdoch, what you've got is someone with the power, you know, to do great harm. But again, I believe in the American people. I believe in the direction our history is going in and toward a more enlightened country. And I think, yeah, this is a big bump in the road, and we've got to make sure it doesn't overwhelm us. But I don't think it's the end of the world. I just think it's a big bump in the road.
Okay. So for people who were concerned about Fox spewing distortions 24/7, you know, you really have faith in the Americans to be able to distort reality from to separate distortions from reality.
Yeah, I don't have faith in everybody, but I have faith in the majority of people that eventually they're going to get tired of this. And if you look at Fox, they, you know, they may be the biggest cable news network, but cable news is not all that, you know, a big a deal in terms of people who view television and are sitting down and watching something tonight. It's a small proportion even when the cable shows are popular. And what has to happen is the kind of thing that Rachel Maddow does, which is just point by point going through the sort of nonsense they raise and refuting it. And so that's what's going on. But I think in the broad strokes of things, these guys are going to run out of gas. You can't run on hate forever. You have to have something positive. I mean, look at the Republican Party. You know, it's not just a slogan to say they're the party of no. What do they stand for? Nothing. All they stand for is trying to achieve what Rush Limbaugh said when Obama was elected, and that is, I hope he fails. And that's all
right.
The Republicans have done. They've just tried to make Obama's wish come true. They haven't put anything positive on the table at all. They've just voted against all the initiatives that Obama's put forward. And I think eventually the American people are going to say, hey, you know, look, it's not enough to just say no. You have no alternatives. This is just entirely negative. Obama and his administration and the Democrats are trying to do something. They've done some great things with health care reform and other things they brought to the table. Stand out of the way and let them do. Now, this coming election, midterm elections are always tough for presidents. This is going to be a tough election, but I don't think it's going to be as grim as the pundits have made out.
Okay, well, I hope you're right. One of my listeners emailed in this question for you. Do you believe a person can believe in evolution and still believe in a higher power, goddess or god?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm one of those people. So, yes, I do. I think that, you know, Darwin is absolutely correct. Look, here's how I look at our situation in terms of as human beings. The way I lay it out in Patience for God, this book of mine, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, is as follows. I say, look, you have to believe in paradox, and that is we don't have the answer to everything. What's the biggest paradox? And that it's this. We're biological machines evolved from single-cell creatures exactly as Darwin described, to the best of my knowledge and most people who thought about these things. That's one side of the story. The other side is this biological machine made up of brain chemistry and stardust looks out at the universe around us and other people through eyes that have to be described as spiritual, because we look for meaning and we believe in things like love and altruism and caring for people. Those two things coexist, and they absolutely cancel each other out. And yet here we are. That's who we are. So the very fact that they cancel each other out and cannot be explained, in other words, present us with this huge paradox, means that we have to, instead of coming up with cosmological solutions, saying I'm an atheist and this is the way it is, or I'm a born-again Christian and this is the way it is, you have to have some humility and just say, hey, first of all, we don't know. Secondly, what we do know is that we look at the world around us with spiritual eyes as if we were beings that had some eternal purpose and meaning. That feeling must come from somewhere. That sense of meaning and purpose comes from somewhere outside of ourselves. At the same time, we're evolved biological creatures. These two things coexist. It's an inexplicable mystery. It's a paradox. But sometimes in accepting the paradox, that is the explanation. It's not saying we understand it. It's just admitting what our circumstances are. And the problem is with the opposites, as I talk about in Patience with God, is that when you come down hard on one side or the other, as an atheist or a fundamentalist believer in some religion, what you do is you exclude the true human condition. And the true human condition is one of unresolved paradox. And that is, these things coexist. And so that's how I see it. So I do believe in a higher power, and I do believe in evolution. I don't believe in intelligent design, as if somehow everything can be explained by some higher power designing us. On the other hand, I look at the world with spiritual eyes. The closest relationship I have in my day, these days right now, is helping in the child care of my 2-year-old granddaughter, Lucy. All my meaning is wrapped up in this little 24-month-old human being. How do you explain that? You can explain it because of survival and instinct and genetics, but it goes beyond that. It's this beauty and meaning and purpose we find in daily life, which is what really matters, not the big questions. It's where we live that matters, and where we live is in relationships with people. From a biological point of view, from an evolutionary point of view, those relationships don't make any sense. But there they are. Deal with it. And so I think paradox is the thing we have to learn to embrace instead of looking for these big answers.
Well, in the title of your book, Patience with God, I think you know what you've just said sort of ties into that. But can you maybe explain a little bit more what you mean by patience with God?
Well, I think that, first of all, titles, let's be honest, titles are put on books to sell books, and so the book is about more than that. But on the other hand, this title actually does reflect the book. And the subtitle of the book is Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism. And so the patience comes in, not just with God, but with everything. Look at our discussion about Barack Obama we've just been having. What's missing in the left-wing criticism of Obama?
Patience.
That's what's missing. And so it's this God, let's say God is the word we use to describe all the undescribable, inexplicable things. We have to have patience in the sense that we have to admit, I think, paradox. We have to admit contradiction. We have to say there are certain things that cannot be resolved. That's just who we are. That's where we are. And so the patience element is not just directed towards God. It's the way of looking at things around us. It's saying, look, I believe I'm an evolved creature in a mechanistic cold universe, and yet I look at my little granddaughter Lucy, and she looks at me, and there's a connection there which has to be described as spiritual. There's no words that work for that connection until you get into words filled with meaning, religion, and spirituality. How is that? How do you explain that? Here is the answer. You don't. You just say, this is how we are. These two things coexist. And so the patience with God is really a plea for people to have patience in not trying to decide the big questions, but instead laying them aside and living where we all live. What I need to do is not decide if God exists. I have to live in a place, rather, that decides I want to be a good grandfather to Lucy and give her the best start in life I can give her by enjoying her, by sitting down and listening to music, by putting up a little easel in my office so she can do pictures, by playing with her out on the stone wall next to my house here so she can climb up there with a bowl of water and some sand and a shovel and we can make stuff. That's the point. That's what life is about. That's what we're all after. The patience comes in and not wasting our time going after the big questions, quote unquote, when the big questions are just silly. They're unresolvable. What we can resolve is what sort of parent or grandparent we are, what sort of lover or friend we are, how we treat the people around us, and particularly in family and close relationships. And so I think patience with God, what that title really means, is to have an outlook on life which sets aside the hubris of always looking for the big fix, the quick fix, and instead looks at the details and said, this is where you really live, is in all these details, and let's have patience with those things and do them right.
Two last quick questions, if you can indulge me, Frank,
sure.
A little bit more. You say something pretty, I guess to some would be pretty controversial. It makes perfect sense to me. You say that we need to save Christianity from the Christians. I love that phrase, but
right.
What do you mean by it?
Well, what I mean by it is that when I look at Christianity, I choose the ethics that I believe actually shape the best behavior in human beings. In other words, I don't say I believe every word of the Bible. I don't. But I choose those portions to inform the way I look at things that I think do offer real solutions, as in caring for your neighbor as yourself, as in the parable of Jesus about the Good Samaritan, as in the story in the Bible about the woman, quote-unquote, taken in sin, and Jesus saying, if you're without sin, cast the first stone. I look at these things for inspiration. And so I think Christianity has to be saved from the Christians who instead look at the Bible as a club with which to beat people over the head with whom you disagree on one hand, or to garner votes for a far-right corporate American political party called the Republicans these days, And just like I think patriotism has to be saved from patriots these days. I mean, look, my son served in the United States Marine Corps. He fought in Afghanistan and Iraq. How sick do you think it made me to see people like George W. Bush wrap themselves in the flag as if somehow they represented patriotic Americans and anybody who disagreed with the war in Iraq wasn't a patriot? Well, I disagreed with the war in Iraq, and yet my son was there, and I was very proud of his service, not because he served George Bush. He didn't. He was serving the United States of America, not any particular president. That's what I'm talking about. I think we have to save these things that have been stolen, concepts like patriotism, concepts like religion, concepts like Christianity, and been bastardized.
Even Americanism.
Yeah, even Americanism, American exceptionalism, city set on a hill, the whole thing has been stolen and pilfered from a much greater tradition and narrowed down into this little puny right-wing version of these things, which is exclusionary and mean-spirited. It's time to take that stuff back.
Well,
and
I'm
glad to tell people I'm a Christian, but then I like to explain what kind of a Christian I am,
right,
and try to redeem somebody's image, you know, when they think of Christianity as a totally different and ugly thing.
Well, you know, as I'm listening to you talk, what came to me was what a wonderful spin machine they have. And then I thought, you know what? It's not a spin machine. It's just lies.
Yeah,
you know,
it's lies.
It's manipulation. It's manipulation and lies. And we really should just start calling it what it is. And I think that might help, you know, peel off, you know, the glamour that's on some people's eyes.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think one of the total sins, if you want to put it that way, of today's media is that they don't call it lies. What they do instead is they say, well, you know, we have somebody here from the right who says that Obama's the Antichrist and has two heads and came from another planet. And over here we have somebody from the Democratic Party talking about, you know, actual fact-based reality. Well, the truth must lie somewhere between. So let's hear both sides of the issues. Well, how do you triangulate, you know,
yeah,
Obama's the Antichrist with how's our next budget going to work? You don't. You have to dismiss one group of people and just say, hey, listen, fellas, you're nuts. If you get sane, you know, if you get off whatever you're smoking and come back with a reasonable proposal, we'll dialogue. But in the meantime, forget it. We're not talking to you. So there's no midpoint between a Glenn Beck and a Barack Obama. Barack Obama is a sane, you know, articulate professor who's educated and thoughtful. Glenn Beck is a loud, half-baked charlatan, flaky fella who's an entertainer who will say whatever gets him, you know, the headline, and has no interest in whatsoever in the truth, and will spin any lie he wants to spin, including, for instance, saying that George Soros, who's a liberal activist, bought shares in a Brazilian oil company, and when Obama found out about that, Obama somehow was responsible for the BP oil disaster to help his left-wing friends. Well, if you believe that, you know, then you would believe anything. That's obviously a self-evident, extreme, crazy lie, sort of paranoid type of conspiracy theorizing that goes on the far right. You know, the same nonsense that energizes all these militia movements and all these crazy people. They just have to be read out of the American discourse. So there's no point in dialoguing with these guys. I think you're exactly right. We just have to start saying, hey, this is a barefaced lie. It's not your right-wing view of the same issue. This is not fact-based.
Right.
So I really think the media ought to limit themselves, not to dealing with people they agree with, but dealing with people who are reality-based.
Well, and I wonder too, Frank, oftentimes, I mean, there's no comparison between a Rachel Maddow and, you know, somebody over on Fox,
right,
you know, or even a lot of people on CNN. I don't think these journalists, quote, do their homework,
right,
to really challenge the other side when they spout lies. So
yeah,
they
I
end
totally
up just
agree.
Giving
I mean,
them a platform.
There's a very few people who are challenging. Rachel Maddow's one. There's a number of writers and columnists. You know, Frank Rich at the New York Times challenges them. There's a few other people, but boy, it's far and few between. I mean, the voices of sanity that will actually stand up and just say, hey, listen, you know, Fox is telling barefaced lies are few and far between. And
right,
and Rachel Maddow's one. You know, Frank Rich is another. There's a few other people. You know, we know people personally, but in terms of people with a national platform, there are not many.
Right.
And I think it's because a lot of folks are, you know, some are just lazy and uninformed, but I think a lot of folks literally are just shell-shocked by the extremism of the right, and are still trying to play by rules that are a lot more polite.
Yeah.
They're just not used to this insanity. I mean, it's like showing up for a debate and one guy comes with a wrench behind his back and just clubs people over the head. Well, it takes a few minutes for people to realize, oh, wait a minute, you know, this is not what we signed up for. But I think as time goes on, the shrill craziness that's coming out of Fox will gradually become more apparent for what it is. And I think there will be people in the media who are beginning to say, hey, you know, this is crazy. I hope so. I hope it doesn't go the other way where it's just a question of entertaining ourselves to death and we're in a situation where everybody looks at this as entertainment, doesn't take anything seriously, because that's bad for all of us. We need a serious discussion.
Or worse yet, they won't take it as entertainment. They'll take it as truth.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well,
and that's,
well, Frank,
a problem.
Do you get,
that's a problem.
Do you get much backlash from your old comrades?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously when they write about me, and if people who Google Frank Schaefer will find lots of things said about me that aren't so pleasant, and I get a steady stream of email from folks who I'd rather not be hearing from. But in the main, you know, you just plug forward and keep going. I'm sure that other folks like Rachel Maddow and people get that too. I think I'm a little different because I came from that background, and so there are people who particularly zero in on me and dislike what I say because I've kind of got their number.
Right, right. Yeah, you can expose them. Well, let's end on a positive note. This has been a wonderful interview. Thank you, Frank.
Hey, my pleasure.
I really enjoyed you know, the questions and answers from your publicist, and one of the things I thought listeners might like to hear is your idea of the Church of Hopeful Uncertainty.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a line I came up with in Patience with God, and in the book there, what I talk about is, look, you know, we may be these biological creatures, but we look at the world with spiritual eyes, which is one of the reasons, by the way, I think that women have so much to offer, not just religion, but human life, and that is that it's always been the mother figure, it's always been the goddess figure, it's always been that spiritual center of the home that actually makes everything work. And so I think that that actually ties in very much with some of the themes you deal with on your program. And I think that the Church of Hopeful Uncertainty is people who are hopeful, but at the same time, that hopefulness is based in the fact they're uncertain. It sounds like a contradiction, but it's not, because actually uncertainty is hopeful. It's when certainty comes into play. You know, there's nothing worse than certainty or being sure of some fact that actually excludes other people, when really it's just something you've either made up or latched onto. And so I think that actually uncertainty is hopeful. Certainty is what kills. You know, Hitler and Stalin, Mao and Pol Pot and these folks and the Tea Party and all the rest of them, their problem is not uncertainty. The problem is they're certain. They're certain they're right, and they're going to exclude the rest of us and kill us if they get a chance when it comes to some of the dictators of the past. But uncertainty is a hopeful alternative, and that is, again, embracing the paradox, not being afraid of unanswered questions, of looking and realizing that, you know, okay, we may be these biologically evolved creatures, but we're nevertheless spiritual. How do you explain that? You don't. You embrace it. You enjoy it. The same with human diversity. How do you explain some people are gay and some people are straight? You don't. You embrace them, and you say, hey, this is where we're all at. This is who we are as human beings. We don't need to explain this. We just embrace people who are not like ourselves, because we're all here in the same boat. And that's the Church of Hopeful Uncertainty. It's the embrace of paradox, the embrace of the actual human condition, not trying to explain everything.
I like that. And you could almost say it's a little bit like having faith. It's a little bit about you know, not needing to have all the answers and not feeling vulnerable or afraid because of that. It's like, you know, just take every day as a gift and it's opportunity for wonder.
Yeah, absolutely. Opportunity for wonder, and that's it. The Church of Hopeful Uncertainty.
Well, Frank, thank you so much. Please tell my listeners your website address and
yeah, sure.
The name
anybody
of your...
Yeah, anybody who wants to get in touch with me, it's real simple. Just go to frankschaefer.com. That's FrankSchaefer.com, frankschaefer.com. And my books are all on Amazon, the two most recent titles being Crazy for God, which is my memoir, How I Came Out of the Religious Right, and Patience with God, which is exactly what we've been talking about through this whole hour, and subtitled Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism. So, you know, that's what I do. And my website is frankschaefer.com, and I answer my email. So if you go to the website and do contact and want to send me a comment or a question, I do answer my email.
wonderful. And you do, because you answered me. So as we close, is there maybe one important idea you'd like to leave listeners with that maybe I haven't asked or you haven't
already
covered?
Well, you've asked it, but I just want to emphasize again, you know, there's a lot of back and forth from the left, the right, the middle on Barack Obama, but for my 2 cents worth, this is a great American president and certainly the best president of my lifetime in terms of intellectual capability and courage and everything he faced on day one when he came into office. And I just hope not only do people vote Democrat in this next election, but they vote knowing that we're supporting an administration that if we give them the time, speaking of patience, is going to lead this country out of the woods. And we just need to have the patience and allow this great president to do this. And I think we have a good shot.
Well, I totally agree, Frank. I hope everybody out there listens to what you're saying, and I hope they all get to the voting booth on Tuesday. And when Sarah Palin said we're going to be dancing on Wednesday, I hope she's not dancing on Wednesday.
Me too.
I hope Karl Rove regrets all of that money they spent on commercials and, you know, commercials of lies because, you know, they weren't able to fool most of the Americans for this election.
I hope so.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Frank.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night.
So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking, and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. And you know what? I think that interview with Frank just totally served as a what's the buzz segment. What about you? Wasn't he great? You know, he really has made me feel a whole lot more hopeful about everything, not just the elections and politics and Barack Obama, but Christianity and, you know, not feeling like the whole entire country is being taken over by right-wing nut jobs. So I think I will try to remind myself every day to live in the church of hopeful uncertainty and just be joyous at the wonder and not have to have all the answers. Well, we are coming to the second part of the show. And I would like to just make a few announcements. I wanted to make sure everyone knows that the long-awaited itinerary to Turkey for next November, it is actually finally together. So if you, pretty soon, if you go to my website, it will be up there. In the meantime, I've posted it on Facebook. I've sent, if you're on my email database, I've sent it out, but you can always email me if you want the link to mythictravel.com. Where you could actually probably find it if you just go to mythictravel.com. It's a tour to Turkey in 2011. The pricing is all done. The tour is for men and women, and we're only going to be taking 20 people. So please, if you're being called to make a sacred pilgrimage, make a sacred journey, for all the many reasons people do this, you know, we call it purposeful travel today. We will be in Turkey about a year from now, and that year will fly by. It'll be my third trip there, and you know, it's hard to language, but Turkey really calls to me. I think that energy of Magda Mater, of Kybele, of Artemis, of Aphrodite, of Isis, you know, all of these goddesses are right there, you know, in that part of the world. You know, it was really a spiritual melting pot. We're going to see whirling dervish performances. We're going to do Turkish baths. We're going to have wonderful activities all throughout the trip. It's really going to be sort of a feast for your left and right brain. You know, you will learn about goddess spirituality. During the day as we visit places, we'll do ritual at sites. And in Turkey, you know, it's not a place that's overrun with tourists. And the last two times I went, it was really easy to do ritual at these sacred sites because we were the only group there. So in that time of the year, the first 2 weeks of November, it's not a real heavy tourist time either. So the chances of us being able to really have private time at these sacred sites of Goddess is really, really good. So anyway, it's about $2,300 for 2 weeks, and that includes most of your expenses. I think it doesn't include lunch, and it doesn't include your airfare, but it's really a good deal. I checked around and got the best price. So anyway, mythictravel.com, or email me personally, KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. Also, too, if you're in the Santa Barbara area, we very soon now will have the Gaia Fest, the Gaia Fest weekend event. I was sitting here looking for the description of the event and all the guests, but I seem to have misplaced it. But you can go to GaiaFest.com. I'm actually giving a presentation on Saturday after lunch called Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future. If you want more information about that, you can go to individual presentations or stay for the whole weekend or just go for Saturday and not Sunday or vice versa. It's really very flexible, lots of fun. It's going to be at the Fess Parker, I think they call it the Fess Parker Ranch Hotel. So check it out. I think you will enjoy it. Most of our folks who go come back every year. Well, I think that's probably about all the announcements I'm going to do for tonight. I'm still jazzed over that interview with Frank. I'm so glad he took the time to be on the show, and I hope you enjoyed him as much as I. So I'm going to just go ahead and switch gears here a little bit and start to, refocus on closing the show tonight and tonight's evening prayer. So I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath with me. And bring an even deeper focus from everything we've been talking about. Just try to go within, shift our focus and go within. Go to that place where we connect with the divine, our mother, our sacred self. And I'm going to read a prayer for you from the Goddess Temple in Orange County. I get a new one every month, and this one came today. Great Mother, Divine Source of All, Great Mother, Divine Source of All, this month, with great intention and holy purpose, I gather the sacred ingredients to cook up something wonderful for myself. I am grateful, I am grateful, I am grateful for the strong cauldron, for the abundant cauldron you have given me. Blessed be. And listeners, let me say, may we all find our voice and use it in whatever way we can. I call that being her sacred roar, using our sacred voice. So please, I hope you will take the advice of our guest tonight. And if you know me well, I totally agreed with everything he said about the Democrats and Obama. I think there's just no choice, quite frankly. There is just no choice if you are an average American. If you don't want jobs to continue to be outsourced, if you don't want to have to worry about maneuvering the waters of Wall Street and becoming a day trader. Because, let's face it, do you think the guy or gal, down at Walmart or down at, Burger King or, the lady who sells clothes, or me? How many of us, your friends, can you maneuver Wall Street to invest your money? I'm not saying you can't, okay? But the problem is so many of these companies, don't have accurate portfolios out. I've lost money in Wall Street. I've had financial planners, tell me to invest in this and invest in that. You think they're good companies. And one day you open the envelope and the money's gone. It just happens that fast. When Barack Obama came into office, we had a Wall Street collapse. People's 401ks disappeared. Their pensions disappeared. They probably haven't recovered that money yet. Sometimes you never recover the money. It's really a scary time we live in. We can't be taking away safety nets from people. You know, we can't be expecting people to become day traders, you know, to manage their pensions. It's not like that in other countries around the world, in Europe. I mean, it's just not that way. And, you know, this is just another maneuver. It's another maneuver to steal money from people. I hate to say it, but I'm just going to be blunt. I don't sugarcoat things. You know, we can't risk doing away with the minimum wage. How many people can make do on the minimum wage as it is now? And if we get rid of it, they're going to want people to work for less. Work more, work harder for less. And then they tell you you're not working hard enough if you're not successful. No, we just have to stand up and say enough is enough. We're not going to vote against our economic interests. We're not going to vote for Republicans who are for corporations that want to get richer and richer and richer while they disempower and impoverish the American people. I mean, just look at the statistics. It's right there. It's right there. CEOs make 350 times what workers do. It used to be they made 50 times what workers do. 70% of women already retire in poverty. What's going to happen if they privatize Social Security? One bad investment and your life savings are gone. No, no, we can't let this happen to our fellow Americans, to ourselves. So please, even if you have to hold your nose, even if you feel like not enough has happened, I don't know. I'm just going to say, trust me. You know, I've been following the news. I've been following the news. I know about the obstructionism from the right. You know, I know all the reasons why the Democrats haven't been able to pass everything or pass what we would have liked them to pass. It's simply because we've had some Democrats who don't vote Democrats. Sometimes they always vote for the Republicans. And even though we hear, oh, the Democrats have the majority in the House and the Senate, well, you know, the Senate has 400 bills that the House has passed, bills that would help average Americans, 400 bills that they have sent to the Senate for approval. But all the Senate has done is filibuster things, which means they have not voted on important legislation that would have helped Americans. And I'm sorry if it's cynical. I really do believe it's because they wanted this administration to fail. They wanted people to be disgruntled so that the GOP could get back in power. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox, but it is just so important to understand the circumstances. We can't vote from our emotions. We do have to have patience. We do have to use common sense. You can't dig yourself a hole for 8 years and expect to get out of it in 18 months, not with the overwhelming problems that Barack Obama faced when he went into office. He was faced with cataclysm. Okay, and we didn't fall over the edge of the cliff, and we're going in the right direction. So let's give them some more time. Let's give the Democrats some more time, because you know what? Of the two parties we have to choose from, they are the only ones that have any awareness of social justice, of equal justice, of looking out for labor, of looking out for the average American people. Everybody knows the Republicans are for corporations. They are not for you and me. All right, listeners, well, that's it for tonight. Thank you so very much for tuning in. I will close with one of my favorite songs in my files here, because I feel like tonight has been about, you know, warriors for the good. I'm going to play another song by Abigail Spinner McBride called Am Sekhmet, because I believe the goddess Sekhmet, deity, archetype, or ideal, is about women's empowerment. Here we go, Am Sekhmet by Abigail Spinner McBride.